You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello everyone, welcome to the Daily Nationalist, here on Radio Albion. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today is the 15th of May, 2024, which just so happens to be the 25th anniversary of my doctoral dissertation defense at Nebraska-Lincoln, which means quite a bit to me. 25 years nonstop doing this kind of thing every day. So, given the military situation in Ukraine, I want to deal with two specific things. Scott Ritter put out an excellent article that I want to talk about, really excoriating the make-believe experts on Russian politics and Russian history. Books like Catherine Belton's Putin's People, and of course, Anna Applebaum, who were writing just utter nonsense concerning, since Putin's re-election and some of the revamping of the government, which is normal after an election like this. So Putin was, and then of course I need to deal with the war and, you know, stuff, more recent developments that I've come across since the Belgorod attacks. So this is his fifth term as president. And each election, it seems, he gets more and more support. I came across the Broadway show Patriots, which is supposed to be about Berezovsky, portrayed by one of my favorite actors, Michael Stuhlbarg. The only reason I know about it is he got punched in Central Park and ran after the guy that hit him. And if I didn't read about that, I wouldn't have known about it. And it's getting poor reviews, although he's getting personally good reviews, but I've read maybe 10 specific reviews on this, on the play. So, but what it comes down to, whether it be Applebaum's work in The Atlantic or Catherine Belton or any of these fools, the play is identical. But believe it or not, given Johnson's Law, they get away with talking about Putin as this corrupt autocrat, but worse, governing over a miserably failed system. And it's very easy to refute. Ritter actually uses the word projection, and he's not the only one who's noticed that accusations against Putin's Russia fit the U.S. and the West far better than it does them, and that can't be a coincidence. And what, actually it was 2020, that Applebaum's review came out, but it's the same thing over and over again. He had been reelected in 2018, and what she called it was that Putin had once again created a calcified authoritarian political system in Russia, which includes a corrupt economy that discourages innovation and entrepreneurship. One of the things about pseudo-experts is that they could sound erudite without actually saying anything, and that's what she's done here. Unprovable statements. And of course, no evidence is ever provided. They even go so far as to claim that since Putin has been in power, Russia has become increasingly poor. She actually says this, and this is a few years ago, instead of experiencing the prosperity and political dynamism that still seemed possible in the 1990s, Russia is once again impoverished and apathetic. But Putin's people are still thriving. And that was the most important goal all along. This is what a Pulitzer Prize means today. I don't know if she won it for that, but she's clearly either corrupt or stupid. The two tend to be mutually exclusive, but it's one or the other, because it's hard to tell whether or not she knows this is nonsense, or if she's just so surrounded by the same ideology that she really doesn't know what else is out there. She really doesn't have access to this kind of thing. She is a sought-after speaker on Russia, without seeming to know anything, lamenting Putin's rise to power. And as the West, not to mention Ukraine or Israel, has become actual autocracies, shutting down media on a regular basis, especially in Ukraine, characterizing Putin as the exact same thing. And politics and media is far freer in Russia than it is here. I spent a long time making fun of Michael McFaul, the former ambassador, make-believers like Fiona Hill, Andrea Kendall Taylor, Steve Hall. And, of course, these people were a part of the destruction of Russia in the 1990s. It's very difficult for them, whether they know it or not, to be honest. And here you have a situation where the neurotic defense mechanism actually has a clinical foundation. Now, they have created this make-believe debate where it's only one side, and they deliberately paper over what's actually going on. And unfortunately, the U.S. political class makes decisions based on this nonsense. Now, it's true, while Applebaum, despite her ethnic connections to all of this, the other people that I've mentioned here were active players here. And Ritter is very clear about this. They were active participants in the formulation and implementing American policy regarding Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Harvard University, all the rest, they created policies to exploit Russian weakness at the time for the sole benefit of the regime on both sides of the Atlantic. And as the play on Broadway now, Patriots, says, this unexpected rise, and Berezovsky is depicted as creating him, and Putin then has a completely different vision from Berezovsky and sends him into exile, which was very unexpected. And that when he took over, he threatened to undo everything that the regime had put in place through Gaidar and all the rest. But for an analyst to talk of the 1990s as a prosperous or dynamic era, under no circumstances can you ever call them an expert in Russian politics or probably anything else. It's, as I've always said, simply a propagandist, and they're doing what they're told. To compare 1999 with Russia in 2020, you really need Johnson's Law to work here. Because if no one really knows, you could say anything, and the media does most of that work. Now, of course, Ritter says something else I've been saying for a long time. This is why their predictions are always wrong. The policies that they promote always backfire because they don't know what's happening there. I mean, 100% wrong. The sanctions that have been on Russia since the Obama administration, at least, thinking that it would collapse, some of them are capable of seeing that it has not only revived, but it's expanded. And they don't have an explanation for any of this. They don't have the foundation for it. If you can use two words to talk about the Russian economy today, it is innovation and entrepreneurship. Precisely what you can't say about the American. It talks about their ignorance to a great extent. And you've heard this from me for two decades now. And Ritter has done a tremendous job here. Now, Ritter thinks that people like Applebaum really understand what's happening here. He doesn't mention the ethnic connection, although I do. But in the 90s, of course, Guzinski and Berezovsky and the U.S. government and the rest simply robbed pensioners and the Jewish robber barons of the thrive. And it's that oligarch class. They were brought into being by today's panel of Russian experts. And they are responsible for the anti-Russian propaganda that's everywhere, officially and unofficially. But the Jewish oligarchs connected to political power in the 90s, that was an American-driven scheme launched at Harvard University and within the CIA to destroy Russia. And because it had a strong Jewish element, it became ideologically unassailable. in the 90s, you have exactly the opposite of what they say today. The opposite. It was not dynamic. It was not prosperous. It was the epitome of social calcification. And of course, when Putin began tearing it down, and this is where Ritter says, they turned on him, projecting their own sins onto the new president in classic Orwellian fashion. And today, this is what passes for expertise. These are pseudo-intellectuals and pseudo-experts who either know or don't know the truth of the matter. It is conceivable that, you know, you don't know that you're neurotic, you don't know that you're projecting, or else you couldn't do it. So it's possible that they truly believe this nonsense. And it has a clinical foundation because they really can't talk about the truth because it would implicate themselves and their friends and their colleagues. To tell the truth would force them to reflect on their own wrongdoing in the 1990s. And then everything in their power to keep Russia weak, divided, and destroyed. So their projection is the foundation of their careers and their wealth. Their functioning, their day-to-day functioning, depends on their ability to sustain this projection and the telling of these myths and lies to a public that doesn't know very much. It's a clear defense mechanism for those who are not sociopaths, who then, of course, they don't need defense mechanisms. They're relieving themselves of guilt, assuming they could feel any. But as all of you know, probably, the Russia that Putin inherited from Yeltsin was a broken nation, economically, socially, in every other way. The oligarchy had overwhelmingly Jewish and inserted themselves into the very daily fabric of Russian life. And abulia set in. They thought that, you know, money and power could only come from joining with the West, and they were willing to debase themselves morally. You can't have a nation that doesn't understand itself. Its true nature, as Ritter very, very eloquently says, a nation removed from it is just impossible to govern. Shock therapy in the 1990s was unsurvivable. So when Putin took over, if you know my book on 2012, Russian Populist, Political Thought of Vladimir Putin, which apparently you can only get from the Barnes Review today, you have to go to them directly, which I prefer you do regardless. I get into great detail concerning the actual mechanism of Putin's priorities, fixing first the tax system, then the police, and then the legislature, then the military, and of course having to maintain a certain level of centralization to make this possible. He provided the framework that was able to keep this broken nation together. But of course, he's one man. It took a long time to chip away at the regime. The West was defining democracy as ruled by this Jewish ruling class, and a tremendous amount of damage had been done. I mean, Chechnya alone, despite Putin winning the war, it just proved the condition of the chain of command in the 1990s, and it was emblematic of everything else. Now, he also says something else, and this is my favorite part of what he's been saying recently. He talks about not so much the necessary invasion of Ukraine, was a preemptive invasion of eastern Ukraine, that is to say Russian-speaking areas, but more the Western response. Again, because this expert class doesn't seem to know anything, and they're always wrong, and their predictions are always incorrect, they didn't realize the implications of this back in February of 22, and it gave Putin a very an unexpected boost. His political opponents, such as they were, backed by the West, did flee the country. But when the sanctions concerning the invasion came down, they weren't picky about who they applied to. Either pro-Western oligarchs either fled and took their money with them, or the old oligarchs were sanctioned just en masse, which of course legally you can't do. But that hurt that pro-Western class that came to power in the 1990s. And they were weakened concerning what power they could exert in Russia proper. They, without realizing it, pulled the plug on that powerful class of the Russian elite, who became, this Jewish elite who became intertwined with the Western world. When you chop that, when you sever that, a lot of pro-Western elements are going to be affected. So the response that was crafted by the people I've already mentioned, supported by people like Applebaum and all the rest, as always, their policies, their response backfired. The Western sanctions destroyed that once supported oligarchy, and it boomeranged, as we all know, and it crippled the European economy, especially in Germany and France. Whatever was removed from Russia due to sanctions, the Russians simply filled it in. That's why unemployment is so low. If anything, they have a labor shortage. It boosted the defense industry. And if there's any place where you have innovation and entrepreneurship, it's there. It's non-existent in the West, very much real in Russia, at least in certain sectors. It's the stagnant economy is in the West. And they, of course, are in a position where they can afford to ignore it. But it also awoke a certain level of patriotism that had always been growing. But you have this new interest in history and religion and culture. And he's been, you know, Putin's been the driving force of this. Most Russians are aware of it. This sense of national pride. The U.S. is no longer a superpower, but the Russo-Chinese nexus is. Russia's one of the few countries that can be completely autarkic, that is to say, not dependent on foreign trade, if they needed to be. And whatever trade they lost with the West, they shifted to Central Asia, India, and China. And they more than, not to mention parts of Africa, they've more than made up for it and rendered themselves now even more impregnable to sanctions of all kinds. Now, we talked about this in the past. His re-election was 88%. And the turnout rate was about three quarters, a little bit more than three quarters. Now, he usually has mandates like this, but these numbers are impressive even for him. And it makes sense under the circumstances. So the oligarchs have been neutered by sanctions, let alone what Putin has done to them. Now, he can enact even more economic reforms to reinvigorate the Russian economy that was already expanding substantially. And the massive reinvestment of resources that at one time had been taken out of Russia. The war in Ukraine wasn't merely about two Slavic peoples, especially in Chabad houses. You know, they hated them both. But given the sanctions and everything else, this turned into a struggle for the survival of the West. And this is part of what this pool of patriotism that he's tapped into has accomplished. So now, this patriotism is directly linked to the special military operation. And this has a lot to do with the increasingly national economy rather than international one. And, of course, there's no debt. The currency is far more stable. Manufacturing actually exists, unlike in the U.S. And this redefined the entire Russian talking class as well as the political class, making structural changes easy, and then they could last after Putin is gone. From his inaugural address, I haven't mentioned this in the past, but I take this directly from Ritter's article, and I want to quote from it here. Putin said, "It's often said here that the head of state in Russia answers and will always answer for everything. This is still the case today, although I have a deep awareness of my own personal responsibility. I nevertheless want to emphasize that Russia's success and prosperity cannot and should not depend on one single man or political party or political force. We need a broad base for developing democracy in our country and for continuing the transformations we've begun. It's my conviction that a mature civil society is the best guarantee of this development, and it will continue. Only a free people and a free country can be genuinely successful. This is a foundation for both economic growth and political stability. We will do all we can to ensure that everyone here can realize their talents and abilities and ensure that a genuinely multi-party system develops and that personal freedoms are strengthened." And that wasn't that long ago. And he's consistent, remarkably consistent, with the political ideology that I laid out 12 years ago in my book on his political thinking. He's talking about democracy. He's talking about a nationalist one. He's talking about a strong community, and that civil society can't function without the ethnic and religious foundation. This isn't about egocentric capitalism here. He's not talking about success, he's talking about genuine success, and that this is the foundation of any economic growth that isn't based on the usury of buccaneer capitalism, a genuinely multi-party system, not the regime having these various artificial parties. So when you read something like this, and you realize that this is very possible and is already in motion for Applebaum to talk about a calcified political system, of course, is mere projection. And other than that, it's just an invention. And they have come to loathe anything Russian, and ultimately they simply don't understand it. Over and over again, all their predictions have not come true. Their ignorance, their projection has made almost a parody of it. And yet, they have full control over policy. But there's got to be a point where intelligent people start to realize that they are constantly wrong. Their predictions never come true. They don't seem to understand, and will listen more to Scott Ritter and yours truly than this group of hackneyed fools with very bad consciences. Now, on to the field in eastern Ukraine. When I say eastern Ukraine, I'm talking about Russian-speaking areas, most of which have already voted to become a part of Russia. Many of you have heard of the offensive in Kharkov, a Russian-speaking area. That's where Brezhnev was from, actually. And as I mentioned a few weeks ago, the Kiev regime's attack on the northern border and beyond it. Right now, there is not a real retreat. It's a chaotic retreat from Kiev. The Russian progress has been extremely rapid. They can't retaliate, again, militarily, so they attack civilian targets, as we mentioned in Belgorod and elsewhere. It was on the 12th, yet again, that there was another bombardment of the Belgorod region. The city's about 20 miles from the border, deliberately hitting residential areas. That was 3 days ago, and I think the number is 20 dead now, but there's some collapsed buildings, and there's still people to be found, including children. And the Ukrainians use the Tochka-U missile system and the RM-70 Vampire. And you see some of the images on the web about this destruction. These are terrorist acts because there's no military positions involved. It was aimed exclusively at residential areas. So there's no getting out of it. This is clearly a terrorist attack. Of course, I mentioned the types of missiles because this is what Kiev has left. Now, the official statement of the U.S. was allegedly saying that we are opposed to attacks on civilian targets. Of course, they said the same thing about the Israelis in Gaza. It's words, they're words that don't mean anything. But the Russian embassy in Washington came out and said, well, you can't talk about Ukrainian military action without the U.S. Of course, they were part of it. Kiev is a puppet of Washington. It's not an independent country, as I've been saying for 20 years. The West has publicly stated that you can attack civilian centers, but American words have never meant anything in this regard. If it was done, the U.S. not only approved it, but very possibly helped them carry it out. And if not the U.S., then the French or the British. The author, the paper I'm reading now, Lucas de Alameda, who actually just came back from the border region on a BRICS Journalist Association expedition, and he spoke to local military and civilian officials, and they've made it clear that these are not just increasing. I mean, they're scattered, but they're increasing, and they occur mostly on Orthodox holidays. If you remember, in the attack on Serbia, they were deliberately starting it on Pascha, old calendar Pascha. So the only possible reason that they're doing this is to spread fear and terror. And everyone there seems to admit to psychologically destabilize the Russian population. And only civilian targets have been destroyed by these older Ukrainian missiles in Belgorod. So there's no military operation there at all. It's simply to spread fear. This is the very nature of terrorism, and it shows you they're not exactly functioning from a position of strength. So for the Russian movement against Kharkiv, which is Russian anyway, after the terrorist attacks, the Russians hit the Ukrainian side very intensely, and the chaotic retreat began. The Russian army advanced on the ground. They took Russian-speaking villages without any problems. And Kiev simply abandons their trenches. They're not fighting back very much. So you have to put the attacks on Belgorod in that context. It's a reaction to the fact that they can't fight back very well. They retaliate not militarily, but by killing civilians. They're not targeting Russian military positions. They're targeting residential areas. But that's nothing new for either the U.S. or Kiev. So this can only harden Russian resolve here. And the Russian army can continue to advance with minimal casualties. They're liberating its own territory. And even though this wasn't policy in the beginning, they have to hit infrastructure facilities to keep anything like the attacks on Belgorod from happening again. And the calculation is very simple. The more attacks the Ukrainians or Kievans engage in on these peaceful border regions, the more intense the response is going to be to neutralize them as quickly as possible. And the chaos in Kiev continues to get worse. The head of the Kharkov division, Yuri Golushkin, was dismissed yet again and replaced by a low-level general, Mikhail Drapaty, who was one of the deputies in the Ukrainian general staff. Now, this is the second time in 2 months that Kiev has replaced someone in this office. That a member of the general staff was assigned to the Kharkov area indicates that they've tried to make this a priority, and the Donbass itself will end up being neglected, which means the Russians will have no difficulty there. So the outcome is very clear. And it's my opinion that the military in Ukraine has to take over the government, overthrow the American clique, and pull themselves out of this war for the sake of their own men and for their own reputation. But even late last year, it was very clear, and I reported this, that Zelensky's attempts to hold his grip on power were weak. And it's not just limited to the military, but also to all aspects of political power. He fired Oleksandr Tadasovsky, who was the head of the Foreign Intelligence Service, the SCRU, because Tadasovsky said he was being spied on by his own people, meaning that there is this huge attitude and general atmosphere of distrust and tremendous factionalism that the U.S. can't control, and it's affecting cohesion everywhere else. Now remember, Zelensky is a Jewish comedian. He doesn't know a rifle from a howitzer. So clearly, actual military men want nothing to do with this man anymore. His Jewish entourage just bought another mansion in Egypt using his mother-in-law's name. Actually, that was a few months ago. And his entourage doesn't have any military experience either. November 18th last year, a high-ranking Ukrainian pilot defected to Russia. A very high rank, actually. The defection was organized by Russian intelligence. Details are iffy, but the new conscription law, which actually goes back to November of last year, but continues to get more draconian as time goes on, the use of combat drugs, the same drugs that were used in the 2014 riots, conscripting people who have no right to be conscripted as cannon fodder, and the drugs are using just to numb them into combat. And no one is spared here. You have people with severe mental and physical disabilities who are being drafted, even pregnant women. You have child trafficking throughout the country, and it's only contributing to this collapse. The regime has tried to play down this disabilities draft, but there was a new legal category created back in November, which was put together by Oleksiy Danilov, the Secretary of the National Security and Defense Council. It's called conditionally fit conscripts. There's a provision for this, which I've found. It actually goes way back, but it keeps getting more and more literal. It'll be in force continuously, and it will be extended. And it's a matter of desperation. There have been reports about people with severe physical disabilities getting conscription notices, including one blind man, and those with no arms or legs. The man with both hands missing was given a notice. But it doesn't stop there. People with severe mental disabilities are also being drafted. Because if they have fairly mild mental problems and yet are physically fit, that's perfect. They're the perfect cannon fodder. And it was actually in July of last year, Maxime Baida, who was 34 years old from Vinnytsia, mentally disabled, with a condition so severe that he couldn't feed himself. His mother is still taking care of him due to his disability. And yet the man was drafted, and the medical commission declared him fit for military service. And I've seen videos. When I publish this paper, I have all the hot links on here to all of these. And I haven't heard a whole lot of this in the West, except for there's been a couple places that have tried to deny it. And I quoted Danilov, who talks about these legal categories. There is fit and suitable versus conditionally fit and suitable. And this interpretation, in his own words, is getting wider and wider. It's a matter of physical fitness, not mental fitness. And younger people and older people are being drafted. And most of you by now have seen the videos. Maxime Baida is just one example, and he is certainly not isolated. It just doesn't matter. If they have bodies, that's what's going to happen. These days, of course, Kiev is hiding the extent of its losses. We all know what's happening. But as I said, strikes against civilian targets, I think it's 2025 by now. And clearly the regime says that Russian civilians should pay the price for their own Kievan incompetence. Total lack of military prowess, though. The corruption is severe. I mentioned the leadership in Kiev. And I have all the data, buying villas and penthouses and seaside resorts and very expensive cars. And the lives of Ukrainian soldiers are completely irrelevant to them. These corruption scandals spring up everywhere because no one really thinks the war is going to be won, so why are they going to sacrifice for it? There was an unnamed senior Ministry of Defense official, late 2023, embezzled $40 million allocated for the purchase of munitions. Using state funds for this fraud, his home was searched by the police and they found all the documentation that they needed. At the same time, where you have endless shortages of every conceivable kind of materiel that an army might need. So he's contributed to the problem that's gotten worse since then, where artillery can only fire once in a while. And smaller Russian units can't even be touched. The U.S. is involved, and I read this on the BRICS site. They're interfering with any attempt to audit not just domestic but foreign uses of this money. The scandals are so constant that the Ministry of Defense is just collectively involved in everything from embezzlement concerning bulletproof vests and food supplies and uniforms at ridiculously inflated prices. And it wasn't that long ago that Zelensky fired everyone in charge of conscription commission. In other words, they were selling exemption notices, making it possible for the well-off, the underground, to avoid being sent to the front. And there, it's gotten so bad that even the U.S. is getting upset. So, other than sporadic drone strikes, there's really not much the Kievan government can do. These are ad hoc measures. They're not coordinated efforts. Even Western media is now admitting that there is no chain of command anymore. And corruption isn't the only reason. There are no fortifications anymore. They don't have the capacity to build them. There's no defensive posture. It's just chaos. You don't have morale. You don't have fuel. You don't have materials. You don't have the manpower. You don't have trained personnel. The Russian military, of course, is superior in every possible way, especially in the air. And so, defenses to retreat and regroup is impossible. So now there's this World War I no man's land. The Kievan troops simply retreat. There's reports of fragging. You all know what that is from the Vietnam era. Having no air power makes any job of fortification building by Kiev simply impossible. And it means that the U.S. is deliberately stretching out this war for the sake of killing as many people as possible. And that's beyond sociopathy, as far as I'm concerned. The superiority of the Russian forces now in everything. It's, the Grad Tornado G, the Orgon, the BM-30, Smerch Tornado S, all of these systems. All of these missile systems are extraordinary, these artillery systems. And Kiev simply doesn't have this material. The Russians are now very experienced in direct fire support. They can clear the way for anything that they want to do. Assault units, the Russian of 30,000 men each, 400, 500 tanks each, the advanced T-90M and T-80BVM, 1,000 armored vehicles per unit. Now, that's not necessarily enough to take Kharkov, because it's a big city. It's the capital of eastern Ukraine. But it really doesn't matter at this point. Operational Group North is organized this way, and they have the Spear of Odin rune they use. The Russian forces deployed are using long range to fight to minimize their losses, which are low in general. But Kiev doesn't have the ability to fight back for very long. They haven't had it in a long time. The huge losses in manpower and equipment from Kiev are going. They can't defend many areas. The Russians move freely. They don't really worry. They could go outside their turrets. And they're grinding down Kievan forces, which now, of course, are very low quality. It's at least, at a minimum, 10 to 1 loss ratio, Kiev to Moscow. And, this has just been a complete disaster for Kiev. They're not announcing their intentions like Kiev does. Last year they were mouthing off about, Kiev was mouthing off about their counteroffensive. The mainstream propaganda went endless, impending doom for the Russian forces in Donbass and Kherson and places like that. But the disaster for the West is that now you have an entire army, very experienced. They've got all the bugs out of their various systems and intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, long-range firepower. And now, of course, at building tremendous defenses. And that means Kiev's equipment losses are, just in the last month, are up 80%. 150,000 irretrievable casualties for Kiev just over the last month, month and a half. And the BBC is not shy about talking about this anymore. Russian losses are and have been minimal for some time. They've lost 53 tanks this year, and the only thing, of course, Kiev has is its PR victories, which it seems to be reliant on. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.